In the novel, these true stories from just after the Civil War mingle with Leonard Pitts's fictional tale.
To me, it's such a fascinating and little-known fact that all of these African-American newly freed slaves went to such great lengths to reconstitute their marriages and reconstitute their families. And nobody really knows about this. Nobody really talks about this. But you've got 20 years after the war of people placing ads and walking across counties and states. And I just like the idea of using real ads to emphasize that this, you know, this is a real story. These were real people who were looking for their loved ones.
And there are so many different little stories that Sam encounters as he travels right. in the South. Slaves who are trying to find their families and their masters won't give them their loved ones back,
right.
or slaves that are killed on the way out.
Right.
What did you want to explore with these different anecdotes?
I just like the idea of sort of giving the full dimension of it. Like, there's a lady in the book who is looking for her daughter, and there's something slightly demented about this poor lady because she's looking for her baby that she hasn't seen in 20 years, and she can't seem to kind of get it through her head that her baby is no longer a baby. Her baby is a grown woman. And that's an actual, you know, that actually happened. And I find that just very painful and very poignant in terms of what it says about what slavery did to this poor woman. So, you know, all these dimensions of things that were happening, we tend to have this image of the end of the Civil War as being the slaves said, okay, we're free now, and hallelujah and jubilee, and threw their hose down and went on to begin, you know, building whatever freedom was going to be. It was a lot more difficult, painful, and complex than that.
Even within the characters themselves, one of the characters, Tilda, the act of walking away from her master is yeah. difficult.
Yeah, that's another thing. There were a lot of slaves who, either because of fear, which is what it was in Tilda's case, or because of devotion, freedom had to be a decision for a lot of slaves. Freedom was not just this automatic thing that came because somebody came and read a notice that said, you all are free now. That's the legal aspect of it. But in terms of the emotional aspect of it, if I've been owned all of my life and I'm 20, 30, 40 years old, I have to define for myself intellectually and emotionally what freedom means and what I can now do.
Leonard, is there a character in the book that you identified with, or that is kind of like taken from your family?
I don't know that there's one who I'd say is exactly like me, but Sam has some of my traits. He's this man who, you know, he was owned along with his wife by a woman who had rather progressive ideas for those times, who allowed the slaves to read, for instance. And he is a man who has sort of taken refuge in books and uses words as a shield. And I do know that if I'm in an argument with somebody who's white and I feel like they're treating me as less than, the verbiage, the level of the verbiage will raise, and I'll start using 5 and 7 syllable words.
Which is what Sam does in the book.
Which is what Sam does. I'll start using words that I'm pretty sure they don't know.
Which doesn't always help him.
I wanted to make that point. And in that, I'm sort of talking to myself as well. It's like, you know, it's a tick. But the fact of the matter is, if people are determined to treat you in that way, you know, you're using, you know, language isn't really going to, it may make you feel good, you know, temporarily, but what else is it really going to accomplish?
And we've talked very seriously about the period, but this is, at the heart, a romance.
Yes.
And you look like a very serious man, but you clearly have a romantic streak.
Yeah, from when I was from very young, all my favorite songs were love songs. I'm just drawn to this idea of you know, particularly in the current environment where we see so much and we talk so much about the African-American family and African-American men and women in terms of dysfunction and in terms of distance and separation. I am just absolutely enthralled by this idea that there was a time when we as African-Americans walked across mountains and meadows to be back together. With no guarantee that I'm even going to find you on the other side of that mountain, I'm yet going to walk that mountain. To me, that is a very, very powerful thing. And that's, you know, that's one of the driving forces that made me want to write this book.
Leonard Pitts, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Writer Leonard Pitts, Jr. You can read his syndicated column for the Miami Herald and in many other papers. His new novel is called Freeman.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we will hear from the Democratic candidate who will face off against Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker in June's closely watched recall election. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett joins us in just a few minutes. But first, we turn to the always emotional, often explosive issue of same-sex marriage. In a move that came as a shock to many people, President Obama announced yesterday that he personally supports gay marriage in an interview with ABC's Robin Roberts. Here's a clip from the full interview that aired this morning on Good Morning America.
At a certain point, I've just concluded that for me personally, it is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
Although many people have long suspected that the president has been sympathetic to same-sex marriage, he has said in the past that he supports civil rights for same-gender-loving couples, but he said that his views on marriage are evolving. But that unequivocal declaration puts President Obama at odds with the presumptive GOP nominee, Mitt Romney. This is a clip from Romney's Wednesday afternoon interview on KDVR-TV in Denver. Let's listen.
I do not favor marriage between people of the same gender, and I don't favor civil unions if they're identical to marriage other than by name.
That discussion, along with North Carolina's vote on Tuesday to ban same-sex unions in the state constitution, has put the issue back on the top of the political agenda. And it also turns a spotlight on the role faith might be playing in the presidential race. So we wanted to talk about this with two journalists who cover the intersection of faith and politics. Sarah Posner is the senior editor of Religion Dispatches. That is an online publication that covers religion, politics, and culture from a progressive perspective. She's also the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Also with us once again, David Brody. He is the chief political correspondent for the Christian Broadcasting Network that was founded, of course, by the conservative evangelical leader, the Reverend Pat Robertson. He is the author of the forthcoming book, The T-Evangelicals, the inside story of how evangelicals, the Tea Party, and presidential contenders are trying to take back America. Welcome to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks
once again.
Thanks for having us,
Thanks,
Michelle.
Sarah, I'm going to start with you. Why now? Why do you think the president made this announcement now?
Well, I think that it was becoming evident that he needed to do something. He was being boxed in by his own position of saying that he was evolving, yet all around him, other Democrats, including his own vice president, were saying that they were for same-sex marriage. And to continue to say that he was opposed to it in the face of public opinion and even in the face of elite opinion was making him look behind the curve.
David, I want to ask you about why as well. And also want to mention in your column about this, you said, this comes as no surprise, quoting here, you say that the fact that the president's views were evolving, and you had that in quotes, on this for a couple of years, simply was code for, let me figure out when best to drop the bombshell. When Vice President Biden seemed to take care of the timing on all that with his appearance on Meet the Press this past Sunday, watching Jay Carney, that's his press secretary, duck incoming fire didn't help.
Right.
That's your usual stuff. But you know, what about Sarah's point is that Pew Research polls, for example, from this year, say that even a majority of independents are in favor of same-sex marriage. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to wait to see how this plays out. I mean, 57%, I think, of independents favor same-sex marriage. If you go deep inside those polls, though, a lot of those rural counties, as it relates to independents, don't agree with same-sex marriage whatsoever. I mean, so I think we wait and see how this plays out. As for the timing of it, all of this, I totally agree with Sarah. And just to say that, look, did the president want to announce this on a Wednesday by calling Robin Roberts over to the White House to make this announcement? Of course not. You know, this was relatively bungled, but done as best possible under the circumstances.
Why was it bungled? Bungled how? You think he was boxed in? He was, in fact, boxed in by Vice President Biden? Because some are saying that, in fact, that he was, in fact, testing the waters. It's kind of like sending up the trial balloon.
Yeah, it was becoming a negative media story for the president. Jay Carney really looking like he was dodging bullets there in the White House briefing room. The vice president, as I like to say, stepped in it, as we shall say, on Sunday. Not the first time, I might say, that he did that. So, I mean, it just was not there to tee up properly, and it seemed a little like a rush job.
What is changed by this, David?
Well, I think we're going to find out. But I think what's going to happen is you're going to see a looser electoral map now. In other words, how to get to 270 electoral votes in 2012. All of a sudden, a lot of red states, typical red states that Obama won in 2008, North Carolina, Indiana, Virginia, Iowa, I can go on.
But tell me why you think that.
But those states, because they are typically, they will typically lean a little bit more red. They're purple states, but they are kind of red leaning, at least in the past. All of a sudden, that opens it up for Mitt Romney to do much better in those states than previously, potentially. So we'll see.
But why do you think that, given that everybody says that people are saying that the economy is number one? I mean, that clearly socially conservative voters preferred other Republican nominees like Rick Santorum. But in the end of the day, it went to Mitt Romney because I think the consensus was that people figured the economy was the issue and he was the best candidate on that issue.
Well, I think the demographics, it depends on each state. But I mean, for example, there's going to be problems, and we'll maybe talk about it within the black community, obviously. That's going to be an issue, not to mention some of the rural counties. And quite frankly, if you look within the independent polling, you will not just see it just be 57% of independents approve of same-sex marriage. Actually, if you look at that socially conservative independent vote, which is what President Obama needs in places like Pennsylvania and others, that has been a problem for him in the past, and it could be even more of a problem in the future.
We're talking about President Obama's announcement that he personally supports same-sex marriage. We're talking with people who spend a lot of time thinking about and writing about the intersection of faith and politics. David Brody is with the Christian Broadcasting Network. That's who is speaking just now. Sarah Posner is also with us of Religion Dispatches. So, Sarah, what about David's point? Two key portions of the president's constituency, the progressive coalition, if you want to call it that, African Americans and Latinos, otherwise strong supporters of the president.
Right.
But on this issue, there tends to be at variance with the perspective of other people within the progressive coalition. They tend to be much more skeptical of same-sex marriage than white liberals are.
Right. Well, a couple of things on that. One is the demographics on that are changing. When you look at the viewpoint of millennial African Americans and millennial Latinos on same-sex marriage, they're much more in favor of it than their elders are. The second is how much this statement that Obama made yesterday will actually impact their vote when they're looking at Obama versus Romney and issues of the economy or foreign policy or the other unemployment, other things that might be mattering to them right now. Are they really going to change their vote based exclusively on Obama's stated position on same-sex marriage? And I think there's not a lot of evidence that that's the case. And I also think that once people start to realize what the strategy has been of the conservative Christian organizations who are opposed to same-sex marriage. The recent revelation that the National Organization for Marriage had a strategy of trying to drive a wedge between Democrats and Latino and African American supporters over this issue. That might give them pause about the motivation of the anti-same-sex marriage movement if they think that they're being used to drive a wedge between their community and the Democratic Party.
David?
Well, let me just make a couple points. First of all, I think this actually could really very much not just energize the president's base, but he really needs those younger, under 30, those millennials to turn out. And so clearly this has political benefit. Obviously, it has a lot of political risk as well. But the truth of the matter is that the problem here, and this is why I think Obama, the advantages with Obama on this, is because candidate Romney isn't the type of candidate that's going to really make this an issue. I mean, he wants to run away from this issue. I mean, look what happened today. Their press people put out this, what's going on in the world today in Romney land, and not same-sex marriage, and the president's announcement wasn't mentioned at all. President Romney, not exactly.
Presumptive Republican nominee.
I've been reading too many Republican talking points, I think. But candidate Romney does not want to touch this issue. And because he doesn't want to touch this issue, I think it makes much harder to basically get some political hay out of this in many of these swing states.
Well, what about the fact that you've also written about the fact that presumptive GOP nominee is speaking at Liberty University this Saturday. He's offering an address there. You felt that this was an important sign. Tell us why.
Sure.
Will he talk about it there?
Well, talk about what? It depends.
It's gay marriage.
No, I don't anticipate that to be at all brought up. And once again, why won't it be brought up? Because Romney is a Mr. Fix-It, the economy, the economy, the economy. It's all he wants to talk about. And so he doesn't want to get down into the social issues. And so that's the reason he won't do that there. But at Liberty University, real quick, no. I mean, he's going to talk about the budget and immorality, and he's going to appeal to evangelicals from an economic standpoint.
So our final thought I wanted to ask you about, the president in his Good Morning America interview, the president said that his faith brought him to this decision. But he also previously cited his faith when he talked about his support for traditional marriage and why he wasn't really ready to go all the way there.
Right.
I just wanted to ask, what do you think it means for the president to invoke his faith when expressing support for same-sex marriage?
I think it's a very important moment for the president politically in terms of how he relates his faith to his policies, and also in terms of how politically, how he has tried to reach religious voters. During the 08 campaign and throughout most of his first term, he has employed this conservative religious rhetoric about traditional marriage and marriage being between one man and one woman, and resorting to that sort of talking point instead of the sort of talking point that he used yesterday, which was about the golden rule and everybody being treated equally. And so I think that that's a very important message, considering that he has in the past not really reached out to religious leaders who are pro-gay marriage and has tended to try to make public appearances with people like Rick Warren or Jill Hunter who are opposed to same-sex marriage. So I think it's an important politically an important message that he's trying to send with regard to his faith outreach and his faith alliances.
Sarah Posner is the senior editor of Religion Dispatches. That's an online publication that covers religion, politics, and culture from a progressive perspective. Also with us, David Brody. He is the chief political correspondent for the Christian Broadcasting Network that was founded by the evangelical leader, the Reverend Pat Robertson, and author of a forthcoming book called The T-Evangelicals. Thank you both so much for joining us here
Thanks,
in our
Michelle.
Studios in Washington,
Thanks,
D.C.
Thanks, Michelle.
And we're going to continue this conversation tomorrow by taking a closer look at how President Obama's announcement will affect the Black community.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
I'm Audie Cornish, and it's time now to Ask a Grown Man.
Ask a what?
Ask a Grown Man. So, thank you.
That's actor Paul Rudd in a monthly video advice column on the website Rookie Mag. The site was started by 16-year-old Tavi Gevinson.
In the videos, famous grown men, including Paul Rudd and fellow actors BJ Novak and John Hamm, answer questions from teenage girls. From The Serious.
Number three, do you think girls and guys can really be just friends?
How do I tell him I don't want to go out with him without ruining our friendship?
One day a guy wanted to get with me, and the next day he already changed his mind. What do I do with this flip-flopper?
To the semi-serious.
Why, twice capitalized, why are men, no, boys, she writes, so obsessed with boobs?
Does the amount of kisses on the end of a text show how much a guy likes you? I've been texting a boy I like for about 3 months, and he sends 5 to 7 kisses, even though I always send 4.
Number three, is it gross if a girl accidentally farts in front of her significant other? Should she feel embarrassed?
Again, those are grown men John Hamm, BJ Novak, and Paul Rudd.
Creator Tavi Gevinson says the idea behind the column is pretty simple.
Adults, you're able to have more of a perspective on what happens since you're kind of able to pull back and see yourself and the decisions you made more clearly, maybe more logically, unless your memory is sort of warped and you've like blocked out part of high school, as many people do.
Indeed, the grown men offer some heartfelt and sage advice. Here's BJ Novak explaining how one advice seeker can tell a good friend that she just wants to be friends.
I'd say if he asks you out, keep saying no for this or that reason. Be honest, be vague. Don't lie. I feel for this guy already. I'm cringing for him. He's going to get some bad news, isn't he? Don't worry so much about the friendship. If you are honest and kind, your friendship will survive anything.
Gevinson says the teens who write in don't know who will be answering their questions. If they did, she says, it might change what they write.
My friend was going, when I told her we got John Hamm, my friend was going to send a question that was like, I feel so ugly, just so she could have on video John Hamm being like, no, you're beautiful.
That's Tavi Gevinson, creator of the website Rookie Mag and its video advice column.
Ask a grown man.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block on a visit today to a garden of wonder. A garden with surprises everywhere you look.
Marshmallow. Look at this. I don't know how that works.
Tall, leafy marshmallow, feathery tansy, hyssop and feverfew, salsify, marrowfat peas, arikara beans, the seed brought back by Lewis and Clark. We're in Thomas Jefferson's vegetable garden, high up at Monticello in Charlottesville, Virginia. A long, lush ribbon of every shade of green you can imagine.
This is a 1,000-foot-long terrace.
Our guide is Monticello's director of gardens and grounds, Peter Hatch.
One person referred to it as a hanging garden because of its plateau. And it's carved out of the southeastern hillside of Monticello Mountain.
So 1,000 feet long.
3 football fields.
Thomas Jefferson, our brainy third president, author of the Declaration of Independence, diplomat, architect, inventor, polymath, was also a vegetable nut. He wrote in a letter, "I have lived temperately, eating little animal food, and that is a condiment for the vegetables, which constitute my principal diet." And over his lifetime, Jefferson grew an astounding number of them, 330 varieties of 99 species. Peter Hatch, with a wild shock of graying hair, shows us around the garden, which he calls an Ellis Island of new and unusual plants from all over the world.
What do we have here on our right, Peter?
We have some, I guess one of Jefferson's favorite lettuce varieties called Tennis Ball.
It's a really beautiful sort of tight, crunchy-looking head.
Yeah, it's a kind of a predecessor of our Boston types that people enjoy today. It's got a kind of a lighter green leaf. Jefferson loved lettuce. He documented harvesting it every month of the year.
Every month of the year?
And sometimes in the summertime our lettuce gets a little bitter, but lettuce was commonly boiled as spinach, as a dressed green.
In a neighboring bed, Peter Hatch points out rosettes of brown Dutch lettuce.
Probably Jefferson's second favorite variety of lettuce. It has that brownish blush to it that's really attractive. And
beautiful.
Sort of it's a basket of vegetable bliss is sticking your head in the bowl of brown Dutch lettuce.
Peter Hatch has worked in Monticello for 35 years now. When he started, this vegetable garden didn't even exist. Much of it was a parking lot.
You know, 40% of the garden was asphalt.
And the rest was planted with flowers. The staff spent years doing archaeological research, consulting Jefferson's detailed notes and drawings to restore the garden to his original design. As for the vegetables, some of what Jefferson planted remains a mystery, but the gardeners here have found and planted many of Jefferson's heirloom varieties to recreate his garden as best they can.
And we got some peas up here, and peas are often regarded as Jefferson's favorite vegetable. He grew some 24 different varieties. Jefferson also had contests with his neighbors to see who could bring the first English pea to table in the springtime.
What was it about peas that Jefferson loved so much?
Well, they're sort of a harbinger of springtime. They're the first kind of fruity thing that come out of the garden. They're sweet. They're fun to grow. I mean, they grow fast. They have this lush green foliage to them. They have pretty flowers.
And I see artichokes in the next bed.
The globe artichoke was a favorite of Jefferson's. Artichokes were sort of a gentleman's fruit in the early 1800s. The wealthiest Virginians grew them as sort of a confirmation and affirmation of their place in the world.
We've been walking through the garden Thomas Jefferson designed for his retirement. After his 2 terms as president, at the age of 65, he returned home from Washington, thrilled to be back at Monticello.
Jefferson wrote, I am constantly in my garden or farms, and I find myself infinitely happier in my new mode of life.
You think that's true?
Yeah, I think Jefferson looked to retirement at Monticello as this great relief from the slings and the arrows of political life. Even as Jefferson was anticipating his retirement, it was this garden, this vegetable garden, that he really wanted to have completed for his arrival here in March of 1809.
It's really impossible to look at this garden and imagine what it took to construct it without thinking about the slaves that built this.
Right. Jefferson wrote that slavery was an abominable crime, but he was a lifelong slave holder. They moved the dirt to create this terrace with a mule and a cart, some 300,000 cubic feet of earth.
All of it supported by a retaining wall of stone they had to build, 12 feet high in places. All his life, Jefferson would collect seeds wherever he went. He brought seeds back from France, where he was minister. Maybe the bees we hear buzzing today and the French lavender blossoms are enjoying a treat he found there. When Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark out west, part of their mission was to bring back seeds from the Indian tribes. He would collect seeds and then share them with his friends.
You know, he played this role of being almost a seedy missionary, this evangelical quest to pass out his favorite vegetables. Jefferson spent a lot more time in the garden than he did in the kitchen, and that's reflected by the fact that most vegetables, when he'd send them to people, he'd tell everybody, well, just prepare it like you would asparagus. Suggesting his knowledge of gardening exceeded perhaps his knowledge of cooking.
Now, the Monticello gardeners let many of the plants here go to seed. They collect the seed and package it for sale to help preserve these historic varieties. And variety was key. Peter Hatch says Jefferson figured out how to turn Virginia's intensely hot summers to his favor.
What he did that was really kind of revolutionary was he assembled this collection of things we take for granted today, from tomatoes to eggplants to okra to peppers, from lima beans to sweet potatoes, from peanuts to crowder peas. And he adapted this garden to really take advantage of this crop ripening sunshine to grow things throughout the summer months. That was really kind of unusual.
And no detail was too small for Jefferson to document in brown ink in the garden book he carefully kept for nearly 60 years. The number of peas it took to fill a pint jar, 2,500. The day his first spear of asparagus pushed through the ground in 1794, March 27th. You can imagine Thomas Jefferson at the end of his life, here in his Monticello garden, maybe bending down to sprinkle the thimble full of lettuce that he said should be sowed every Monday morning from February 1st to September 1st. Gardening, says Peter Hatch, was Jefferson's defiance of age.
For Jefferson to come out into this garden was sort of an affirmation of his vigor in so many different ways. And even at the age of 83, Jefferson read about giant cucumbers in a Cleveland, Ohio newspaper, and he wrote to the governor of Ohio and asked him for seeds of this cucumber and passed them around to his friends in Charlottesville, grew them in his garden, typically measured how long each one was that came out of his garden. And Jefferson once wrote that, although an old man, I am but a young gardener.
That's Peter Hatch, director of Gardens and Grounds at Monticello. He's just published a new book about Jefferson's garden and its history, titled A Rich Spot of Earth, Thomas Jefferson's Revolutionary Garden at Monticello. You can find an excerpt of the book, also a slideshow of our trip to the garden, and links to some Jefferson family recipes. That's on our food blog, The Salt, at npr.org.
And speaking of recipes, a reminder about our Lost Recipe project. If you're having trouble recreating a family recipe, either it's not working or you never had it to start with, write us. Just go to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Remember to put Lost Recipe in the subject line, along with a bit about the original cook. We've lined up kitchen detectives to help you get that family favorite back on the table.
In Greece, economic and political turmoil have left Greeks feeling divided and deflated. The talk in Athens today was all about new elections and an uncertain future. But it was a different scene in the southern town of Olympia. That's where, earlier today, the Olympic flame was lit for the London Games. And as Joanna Kakissis reports, people were able to forget, for just a moment, their many troubles.
Olympia is a small and scenic town tucked into a lush valley of olive trees in the Peloponnese. It's built around the site of the ancient Olympic Games, first held in 776 BC. Olympia's 1,500 residents live off this heritage. There are two museums, though one was robbed in February. The main street is dotted with shops selling souvenirs depicting ancient athletes. 5,000 visitors crowded Olympia's Main Street on this sunny morning. They came to attend Olympia's signature event, the lighting of the Olympic flame. It would begin the torch relay of the 2012 London Games. Chamber of Commerce President Konstantinos Nikoloutsos used the occasion to show off local products.
Extra virgin olive oil, fresh fruits, and also pickles. We're making pickles from pepperoncini.
The crowd walks through fields of blooming flowers to reach a grassy slope above the stadium. The people listen to an actor declare, "This is where the light will be reborn." Schoolteacher Sofia Mermela drove 2 hours to attend. Like many Greeks, she's had her wages cut because of austerity measures that have dragged the country's recession into a fifth year.
Because of the economy and the instability of the government this year, I feel a little sad. I know my country's managed to get out of much worse in the past. I'd like to think we can do it again. It's our responsibility.
Sophia holds up a Greek flag. She and the rest of the crowd clap when ceremonial priestesses in cream-colored robes dance in. An actress posing as the high priestess appeals to the sun god Apollo. She ignites the Olympic torch in the temple of Hera with the help of a parabolic mirror. She passes the torch to Spiros Giannotis, a Greek swimmer born in Liverpool. He begins the 7-day leg of the torch relay in Greece. The torch will be handed over to the London 2012 organizers on May 17th in Athens. When the crowd walks back to town, Corina Spiliopoulou is waiting for them. She has a stand with photographs.
We made pictures of the opening ceremony for the Olympic Games in London 2012 and hope to sell them to the tourists, to the local people, so they have something to remember.
Are people buying them today?
Not as expected.
She says she practically sold out of the photos in 2004 when Athens hosted the Olympics. Now the economic crisis has hurt Olympia. Everyone seems to blame Germany, and that's Corinna's home country. She's married to a Greek and says Olympia's her home. She's lived here for 20 years.
It's the first time that so many shops also on the main street are empty. Nobody takes the risk to rent them. Tourists spend less money than they used to.
By midday, she has to close up shop too because there's a big rainstorm. And as the rain pours in, the town empties. The crowd packs into buses and leaves. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in ancient Olympia, Greece.